This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hollywood movies make up just one part of the global cinema landscape. We'll talk with a Wisconsin film expert on why we should give foreign language movies a try and where we can get started. Now, President Biden signed into law the Postal Service Reform Act last Wednesday, giving the U.S. Postal Service $107 billion in funding for an overhaul of the organization. The bill was passed by the Senate and the House with bipartisan support. Under the new bill, the Postal Service will have the ability to modernize parts of its agency, including replacing mail delivery trucks, some of them with electric vehicles. The bill will also require retired USPS employees to enroll in Medicare. But that's not all. Our guest reports that changes are just beginning at the Postal Service. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this Post Office Reform Act? What changes were you hoping for as a mail or package consumer, as a USPS employee yourself, maybe? Have you worried about delays in shipping, delivery, in vote delivery? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jacob Bogage is a business reporter at the Washington Post. Jacob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, this has been like a decade in the works. As you know, you've been following this for a while. Remind us what led to the need for this bill to get through Congress.
First and foremost, we as a country are all sending less mail. And the Postal Service gets its funding through the sale of postage products when we send letters and receive packages and things like that. When it gets less business, it has less revenue. And it had this requirement to fund in advance its retirees' healthcare costs. Mail work is physical work. It's moving pallets of mail. It is getting in and out of a postal truck or reaching out the window all the time. It's physical work. And they wanted to take care of these. Congress wanted to take care of postal workers' retirement healthcare costs in advance. But when we send less mail, the Postal Service doesn't have the money to make those payments. And that rising debt, it hasn't been able to pay it off since 2011, has kept the Postal Service from modernizing and matching consumer habits for the 21st century. And so what this bill does is it removes those past due amounts and future amounts in the order of $107 billion, ideally to let the Postal Service put that money into modernizing and serving consumers of the 21st century.
You talked to Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. Your interview with him dropped, I think, just this morning. Doesn't seem like he's dusting off his hands and saying, all right, everything's fixed now. Exactly the opposite. The hard work starts now, it sounds like.
Yeah, there was a difficult task in securing this kind of financial relief. But there is an even more difficult task now in implementing a lot of these changes that he's talked about. I mean, you get glory and headlines for shepherding legislation through Congress. Nobody's really coming in to ask, how can I help you fix up a postal plant? How can I help you renovate the lobby of, you know, this post office? These are things he's going to have to do largely on his own, out of the limelight, and without a lot of help. And that's why he's clear-eyed, and I think even his biggest critics are clear-eyed that the hard work starts now. The Postal Service, whether Louis DeJoy is going to be the one to do it and whether they follow his ideas or not, somewhere down the line it's got to be transformed because consumer habits just don't align with what our mail service does in this day and age.
What kind of changes should Postal Service customers, whether we send and receive mail, send and receive packages through the post office, what kind of things might be changing in the near term?
Well, I think one thing that postal customers have probably noticed already is that things are taking longer to arrive and they're more expensive. The Postmaster General, I mean, he was very candid with me about this, that taking a piece of mail an extra day or two to arrive is not the most of his worries. I mean, that if folks need instant communication they can send an email or a text message, and if they've got to get something across the country real quick, they can pay extra to do it. That's not really where he wants his service to be. So slowdowns there and higher prices. And I think for Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, that is to set a new expectation of what the Postal Service does for, you know, means to everyday Americans, and to try to reorient it to more business solutions and to work more with businesses in terms of e-commerce and package shipping. That's going to be a major change. It's going to be a major change for how consumers notice the Postal Service and just how this gargantuan agency's operations are oriented to serve its biggest customers.
Talking to Jacob Bogage, reporter for the Washington Post, covering business and the U.S. Postal Service, looking at the Postal Service now. A new law passed Congress, signed by the president, offers some funding, some relief in debt obligations for the Postal Service. A lot of changes, though, maybe in the works. And you can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you okay with paying a little bit more? Things taking a little more time and that being the new norm? What kind of changes would you like to see? What kind of questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jacob, packages, a big part of the story here. And Amazon, a lot of their packages go through the U.S. Postal Service. The grocery store I shop at is across the street from an Amazon distribution center. I see a lot of Prime vans driving around there. Is that a worry for the post office? Amazon and maybe others are just going to deliver their own stuff as much as they can.
Yeah, that is a major worry for the Postal Service. Amazon is the Postal Service's single largest customer. For a lot of the places where Amazon delivers, it just does not make sense for the company to make its own deliveries. It can do it cheaper by handing it off to the Postal Service to do it. They're too far away. It's not as dense of a community. But Amazon has used the pandemic and the Postal Service's struggles to expand its network. By some estimates, it delivers 72% of its own parcels. Only 2 years ago, it was 50%. So that number is really rising. And as Amazon claws back more of its business, the Postal Service has to look elsewhere to replace it.
I want to look at a big kind of a side issue that's important here in Wisconsin, and that's those Postal Service trucks. It's been a controversy. How many of them are going to be gas versus electric? How many of them are going to be made here in Wisconsin in union shops or outsourced to the South in non-union shops? Can you catch us up on the saga of these vehicles, Jacob?
Yes, as your listeners in Oshkosh and around the great state of Wisconsin have been following this closely, the Postal Service is preparing to buy up to 160,000 new mail trucks. These are sorely needed. The ones that the Postal Service drives right now are 30 years old. They have been driven into the ground. They burst into flames because of the amount of overuse. So they need these new trucks. Oshkosh Defense in wonderful Oshkosh, Wisconsin, signed an agreement to do that for around $6 billion over the next 10 years. But there was some consternation over how many of those trucks were going to be electric zero emission vehicles and how many of those trucks would be, for lack of a better term, gas guzzlers. When you turn the air conditioning on in these things, they get 8.6 miles per gallon. The Postal Service placed its first order for 50,000 of those trucks. 10,000 of them will be electric, but they're going to get made in Spartanburg, South Carolina, in a non-union shop. And a postal official in front of the House committee just last week admitted to legislators that the Postal Service knew Oshkosh was going to move those jobs from the union shops in Oshkosh to non-union shops in South Carolina even before it awarded the contract. So there's a lot more to be said there, and we're certainly not seeing the end of this controversy.
Yeah, are politicians from states like, say, Wisconsin expected to raise a stink about that?
Some are and some aren't, and I would expect it to play heavily in the Senate race coming up in the midterm elections, where Senator Ron Johnson from Oshkosh, by the way, is up for re-election. He's been pressed on this about jobs leaving this community and has said Oshkosh already has enough jobs. We don't need them. And he's really gotten hammered for that by folks running in the Democratic primary, I would really highly expect that to become an issue in the general election. And Democrats are defending this really narrow, I mean, unbelievably razor-thin narrow majority in the Senate and in the House. And they look at Wisconsin as a place to potentially pick up a seat, especially if they can win over union and blue-collar workers who have drifted a bit to supporting Donald Trump and Republicans in recent years. And Oshkosh is a community where they're going to need to pick up votes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm just questioning why he's choosing to delay the first-class mail. That's actually our bread and butter. And, you know, it shouldn't be delayed. It's almost like he's forcing people to pay their bills online, and we think that's wrong. And, you know, some of the packages that we're delivering for Amazon, you know, they're bed frames. They should be delivering them. We should be delivering packages that fit in the mailbox, not having to wreck our bodies. Let them wreck their bodies. You know, that's what Amazon's all about. Let them handle that.
And Mary,
so we're a little confused.
You work at the post office yourself, it sounds like?
That is correct. Mary from Milwaukee.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Jacob, yeah, if Mary says if first class letters, they get more expensive, they take longer, is that going to push more people to, as she says, pay bills online?
Absolutely, it does. Look, I pay some bills online, and I get certain financial statements or insurance statements. I get those in the mail too. And I'm sure some of your listeners will notice this. Whenever you log into online banking or something, or maybe your doctor's office or insurance, do you get a little pop-up on your screen that says go paperless? Or does it say we're going to start charging you $5 a year service charge to mail you your statements? This is the kind of thing that the Postal Service has to contend with, that every time they raise prices or slow down service, there is going to be businesses who say, this is not worth my money anymore to keep my mail in the system. I'm pulling it out. And Mary in Milwaukee raises a great point about Amazon packages. And I cannot tell you the amount of postal workers who talk to me and say, I am slammed with Amazon packages. I go home at the end of the day and I collapse into my bed because I'm exhausted from hauling these things all over town. These are, you know, packages represent a complete transformation of what the Postal Service is designed to do. It is designed to move paper. It is not designed to move cardboard, which is bulky and heavier. They don't go through machines as easily. That is where Louis DeJoy is really going to have some issues reorienting this gargantuan federal agency to a completely new purpose.
Thanks for that call, Mary. Jacob Bogage is with us, business reporter for the Washington Post. He's talking about the Postal Service Reform Act passed by Congress, signed by President Biden. Big changes on the way at the USPS. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about your mail service, your package delivery service as a consumer, as a business person yourself, maybe? What do you think about this truck thing? Should there be more electric vehicles in the mix? Should they be made here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Jacob Bogage on the Postal Service Reform Act, what it means for the future of your mail. Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. We'll go back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Chippewa Falls. Mark, hi.
Hi. I just want to bring up that we've got global warming to worry about, and we've got Putin who needs to sell his oil. If we're going to demonstrate to the world we are reducing our emissions and that we're serious about these two things, we ought to be addressing that by replacing this fleet of vehicles for the post office with vehicles that are powered by electricity, not gasoline.
Gotcha, Mark. Thanks for the call. Jacob, you talked to Louis DeJoy about this. You said, yeah, you've got 10,000 electric vehicles. He says, well, 10,019 on the way. Jacob, what is the reasoning for not having more of these vehicles be electric, as Mark is asking about?
The Postal Service, and I want to make clear that this is the Postal Service, says that it, A, doesn't have the money to buy more electric vehicles, and B, doesn't have the knowledge, and the electric vehicles aren't up to snuff yet. Now, let me put both of those points in the context. On the money, the Postal Service has between $20 and $24 billion sitting in the bank right now in cash. Electric vehicles at their most expensive will cost $11 billion. So they do have the money. Are electric vehicles up to snuff? They've done analysis that says no, that they're not right for the use case of the Postal Service going mailbox to mailbox, stopping and starting, getting charged and plugged in at post offices when they are done with their routes. Electric vehicle experts and folks who are completely independent of the Postal Service say this is exactly the perfect use case for electric vehicles. When you drive your car on the highway right now, if it's a gas-powered car, it gets better miles per gallon on the highway than it does in the city because it's not stopping and starting. The opposite is true for an electric vehicle. It actually gets better mileage stopping and starting than it does in long stretches on the highway. So there's actually a more efficient use for the Postal Service to use electric vehicles than it says. There is a lot of congressional oversight going on around this. There is $6 billion being debated in Congress right now to try to get that funding to the Postal Service to help them buy electric cars. There's also likely going to be lawsuits from environmental groups who say that the trucks that the Postal Service is slated to buy right now will do permanent harm to the planet and to public health. And so there's, again, a lot up in the air right now, and I think your caller raises a great point.
Thanks for the call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. Mary joins us next in Edgerton. Mary, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My suggestion slash comment is I stopped writing anything over the email because it wasn't anybody else's business ever what I was saying to my family and friends. And so we all write letters again. And my suggestion is, can the post office do some kind of public service announcements that would encourage people to write letters? And maybe then the postage wouldn't have to go so high.
Mary,
that's my thought.
Mary, thanks for the call. Jacob, I think letter writing, I'm guessing, has gone down in part because of the email, as Mary mentioned, also because of social media, of course. Is there a hope for a turnaround encouraging us to write letters again?
Yes and yes. Letter writing definitely has gone down because of emails, because we can pick up the phone and call people. I cannot tell you the amount of people who have told me I've gotten back into letter writing, or I send thank you notes by hand, or I'm getting married and I could tell people to RSVP online or through email, but instead I'm going to have them mail RSVPs back to me. That's not necessarily enough to stem the tide of declines in mail use. But look, it's something that I've done in my own life, and I've gotten enjoyment out of it. So why not?
Thanks for the suggestion, Mary. We are talking to Jacob Bogage from The Washington Post, looking at the U.S. Postal Service. Big changes passed in Congress, more to come. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. We heard from Susan in Waukesha, who can stay on the line, wonders about potential conflicts of interest for Louis DeJoy. This has been a concern since he was appointed to the Postmaster General spot. What is the latest on that kind of concern, Jacob?
So, wow. that's a big question. And I think the best way to answer that is, in broad strokes, the conflict of interest regulations are designed not only to help folks in office in government avoid legitimate conflicts of interest, but also the appearance of conflicts of interest. And so if you're butting up against what is an appearance of a conflict of interest, that in itself is problematic. When we talk about Louis DeJoy specifically, we're talking about his former employer, a company called XPO Logistics. He continues to own buildings that he leases to XPO Logistics. XPO Logistics is a major contractor of the Postal Service. There's also been some reporting recently that Louis DeJoy owns stock in Abbott Laboratories, which is one of these companies that makes COVID-19 tests. And of course, some of those tests are being shipped out by the Biden administration through the Postal Service. That one, talking to ethics experts, they're a little bit less concerned about, because DeJoy has owned stock in Abbott long before the pandemic started. He doesn't really have any say about what kind of tests get sent out. And he can't offer preferential treatment to Abbott tests versus non-Abbott tests. But again, the entire purpose of conflict of interest regulations is to avoid even the appearance of a conflict. And, you know, we live in a representative democracy. These are the kinds of things that if listeners are concerned about, you know, this is their government and they have every right to engage their representatives about it.
And just briefly, there's concern also, and I think Susan had also brought this up, about retirement payments for current and former Postal Service employees. Is this something that's tackled in this new legislation?
It is. And so if you're a current retiree, nothing's going to change for you. But if you are a current employee, you're going to get integrated into Medicare. Your premiums should stay about the same. And so should the benefits that you get, because the postal retirement system as it was already based on Medicare and different civil service retirement programs.
And just very briefly, Jacob, what are you watching for next?
Oh, the trucks. Are they staying in Wisconsin? Are they going to South Carolina? Are they going to be electric? Are they not going to be electric? I say let's just play a college football game and settle it that way. The Badgers and the Gamecocks, and see what happens.
All right. I'm there. Jacob, thanks again for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure.
That's Jacob Bogage, business reporter for The Washington Post. He follows the U.S. Postal Service very closely. He joins for a look at new funding approved by Congress and potentially lots of big changes in the works for mail delivery, package delivery, and more. Still time to share your thoughts. By the way, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Here's an update from a conversation we had last month. I talked to UW-Platteville professor Andrei Ivanov, who is in Poland helping his parents escape from Ukraine and the Russian invasion. He and his parents are in Wisconsin now. WPR's Jonah Blekas caught up with them and wrote a piece at WPR.org with more details about their journey out of their home country. You can find that at WPR.org/Central Time. Look for the related links section. You can also listen back there to my interview with him. Now, we here at Central Time enjoy our movies, as we know a lot of you do, too. In the past, we've talked about the all-time great movie musicals, animated pictures, movie soundtracks, and more. Today, we put the spotlight on another big part of cinema, foreign language films. You might have noticed some more recognition for these movies at the Oscars in the last couple years. Drive My Car and Minari were recent nominees for Best Picture. In 2019, Parasite became the first foreign language film to take home the Best Picture title. But there's a world of movies out there. Where do you start? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foreign language films? If you do watch them, do you remember the first movie you saw that was in another language? Have you seen any of those recent foreign language Oscar nominees? If you avoid them, what's the biggest barrier for you? And if English isn't your first language, what was your first exposure to English language movies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She wrote the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here as always, Rob.
Let's start with the elevator pitch, Jocelyn, for somebody who's maybe reluctant to check out films that aren't in their native language. Let's say English for now. Make the case of what we have to gain.
Yeah, you know, there are so many ways to tell a story out there, and they really are not restricted to the way that we tend to do it in English-speaking film, whether it's American or Canadian or films made in the UK or anything like that. If you restrict yourself to just those kinds of narrative, you're missing out on the absolutely massive amount of film that's available from around the world. And right now, with all sorts of streaming accessibility, this world is available right at our fingertips. It's just a watershed moment for having access to films from all around the world. It's the perfect time to get started. And if you don't do this, well, you miss out on ways that culture is just this incredibly constantly evolving and moving thing. We might recognize national borders as things that are kind of rigid, but culture doesn't. And so it's a really great time to open yourself up to all the different ways that you can experience how stories are told from around the world.
And as I understand it, you know, Hollywood movies and other film traditions, they kind of talk to each other and influence each other and shape each other. Where can we go to see some of the things that might have influenced some of the movies we've seen and vice versa?
Yeah, this is such a wonderful example of how English language film, especially for our case, Hollywood film, has an impact on foreign language film. And then foreign language film has an impact on what happens here as well. So one of the great examples we can think about is the French New Wave in the 1950s and 60s. And we think about this as kind of like the height of intellectual filmmaking, right? Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, they really transform how we understand how movies work. But this didn't come about generous, right? They didn't just like come out of nowhere developing this. They were actually deeply inspired by American filmmakers like Orson Welles or John Ford, even Charlie Chaplin, Howard Hawks, right? So if we think about somebody like Godard and his really, really famous film Breathless from 1960, which really puts the French New Wave on the map around the world, that film is deeply inspired by American film noir, right? And later he makes things like Alphaville, which is of course very influenced by science fiction, especially American science fiction. Or we can think about other films that move from language to language, something like one of the first foreign language films that I saw, Purple Noon from 1960, which is directed by René Clément. That was made in French as well as Italian and English, but it was based on Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which was written in English. And then, of course, that novel is then remade into another movie in 1999 called The Talented Mr. Ripley that is made in English. So we can see that there's always this kind of like back and forth conversation. And it's really a wonderful way to understand how these stories transform via different directors and different filmmakers in different parts of the world.
We are talking to UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies. She is begging and pleading with us to check out some foreign language movies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to watch foreign language films? You can name names if you have favorites. Do you want some suggestions? You like this, so what might you like? Jocelyn might well have an answer for you. Are the subtitles an obstacle? They are for a lot of people. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Jocelyn, the subtitles are a hurdle. It seems like an extra work sometimes. Some people in my household, I won't name names, so they sometimes watch phones while they're watching films on the TV. I don't know. How do we overcome that subtitle hesitation if we have that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wish I could solve the scourge of people looking at their phones while they're watching movies, but that's beyond the foreign language problem, right? But I understand this, and I actually get it from my students too, many of whom have never seen a foreign language film before they come into a film studies classroom. And I think there's a lot more of anxiety around subtitles than there really, really needs to be. The number one thing that I always tell my students and that I would tell anybody who's feeling a little bit reluctant to dive in is just not to stress it so much. You know, a good filmmaker is going to provide you with so many visual and aural cues for what's happening that extend beyond what the characters are seeing. It's really important for us to remember that film is not literature. The words matter, the script matters, but it is definitely not the only thing going on. So if you miss something, that's okay, because you're going to get most of it in context. And I'll give you a little example, because Parasite, you know, just really burst onto the scene and really transformed, I think, a lot of American spectators' relationship with foreign films. There's that wonderful moment where the Kim family, who are the kind of protagonists of the film, where they're leaving the rich family's house in the middle of a rainstorm. And we watch them move from this gorgeous, spectacular, wealthy, you know, exquisite house that's kind of like at the top of this hill, literally down into the urban depths. We follow them over the course of several minutes during this rainstorm as they move into like increasingly dirtier and more cramped urban situations until finally they're at their very dingy basement apartment that's flooded. Very little is said in that sequence, but we learn everything we need to know about the family's class and position just from watching them move through the city. And that's what a good filmmaker will give you. You don't have to stress so, so much about trying to catch everything. You're going to understand it from the entirety of the context.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi. In the 70s, I saw a film called La Cage aux Folles, and it was subtitled. And later it was made into a blockbuster hit with Robin Williams called The Birdcage. And I really think that there was a lot lost in the translation from the French to the English version.
Lori, thanks a lot for that call. I think I seem to recall the original of that was actually fairly successful, as foreign language films go, in the U.S., Jocelyn.
It was. And I think that's an example of how certain genres can make foreign language films really appealing too, right? Because that relies very, very much on the musical, right? That is a musical and there's a lot of music in it. And music is also something that expresses emotion past what the words are saying. So it's a great example of how a film that might be shot in a foreign language can provide additional information beyond the verbal to give us insight into what's actually happening in the story.
Thanks for the call, Lori. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, UW-Milwaukee Film Studies professor, about foreign language movies, where to start, why it's worth it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out foreign language movies? Is it an area you still want to explore? Do you have a favorite, a country of origin for movies made outside of the United States? Name names, recommend movies, 800-642-1234, or ask for suggestions, 800-642-1234. We'll get some suggestions coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about international films and movies and languages other than English with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with a movie to recommend, a question. If you need a recommendation, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Jocelyn, want to get into some of your recommendations. Now, you had one, a Japanese director named Kurosawa. And I'm like, oh, I heard him. Nope, not that one. Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Tell us a bit about his movies and why they might be a good starting point.
Absolutely. I mean, you can watch Akira Kurosawa. He's perfectly good, too. But Kiyoshi Kurosawa is one of my favorite filmmakers. And the reason I wanted to talk about him a little bit is kind of relevant in terms of what our caller just talked about, which is that he is a fabulous genre filmmaker. So there's two films that I'd point to in terms of ways to get your feet wet with foreign language films. The first one is his film Pulse from 2001. And this is a horror movie, but it's a movie about ghosts on the internet. And so it's really, really prescient because it contains all these anxieties, these kind of like millennial anxieties around what the internet means and how we might lose ourselves and all become kind of like spirits or ghosts moving through the internet. It's so prescient. It's really, really scary. And it's a wonderful example of the absolutely fantastic ghost movies that have been coming out of Japan for decades. I mean, if you're a horror fan and you're not watching Japanese cinema, you're totally missing out. But he's also really good at melodrama. And in 2008, he makes this absolutely gorgeous family drama called Tokyo Sonata, which is about a family, a pretty average upper middle class family in Tokyo, where the father loses his job during the recession, but he pretends to keep going to work, and all of these kinds of rippling effects that this has on his entire family. And it's a real weepy movie. It is absolutely gorgeous. And you could hold it up next to any exquisite family drama coming out of Hollywood.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. So one of the foreign language film I just recently watched in the past 6 months or so was a film called White Tiger. It's a Russian World War II movie, and the general concept is there is a white German tiger tank that will suddenly appear on the battlefield. It's almost like a ghost. It comes in, slaughters the other side, and then disappears. And at the end, there's this duel between a Russian and this German tank. And yes, it did have subtitles, but you know, after a while, you get used to those. And I would highly recommend that one.
Thanks a lot for that call. That's a great moment when I have watched movies with subtitles where it hits me. I forgot I was watching subtitles, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you're really, you've like hit the kind of flow state, right? It's like everything is working in conjunction with everything else in a really, really beautiful way. That's part of why I encourage people who are a little anxious about this, just not to stress it so much, because you will get to that point. You definitely will get to that point.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. White Tiger, Jerry joins us now in La Crosse. Jerry, hi. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. I just love foreign movies. It's almost all I ever watch nowadays. I'm tired of all the explosions and, you know, shootings and all that sort of thing. But I wish I could think of more. I've got hundreds of them that I love. But one I can think of right now is, I think I'm Not Here Anymore. I Am Not Here Anymore. It's about a sort of a cult of music fans from Mexico. I don't know if, I hope I have that name right.
I'd look it up. I'm No Longer Here. Could that be it?
That's it. I'm No Longer Here.
Excellent. Jerry, thanks. That's I'm No Longer Here from Mexico. Any Spanish language movies? They'd probably have a decent audience jostled without subtitles in the U.S. Anything from Mexico or beyond you'd point us toward?
Oh, wow. I mean, so much. One of the greatest living filmmakers right now is, of course, Pedro Almodovar, the wonderful Spanish director who's had just a many decades. I mean, almost a 50-year career so far. He's been working for so long. So one of the films of his that I really, really, really love is All About My Mother or Talk to Her. They're just gorgeous films that one of the things that's so wonderful about them is that he has really fabulous leading lady protagonists. He's a male director who absolutely loves his female stars. And that's how people like Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, you know, all these amazing actors get their start working with Almodovar.
Thanks a lot for that call. David joins us next in Phillips. David, hi.
Hey, hi. There's one in a sequel. In French, it's La Sorsa, or The Source. And its follow-up movie called Manon of the Strings. This is a series of movies that is an amazing family saga and has many nuances and depth to it. I think many people will enjoy it.
Any big names in that one, David?
Yeah, Gérard Depardieu, a young Gérard Depardieu, and a French actress, I can't remember her name, very famous actress. People will know when they see it.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, David. Yeah, French movies. They've made a movie or two, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no such thing as the tradition of French cinema. One of the things that I'd love to point out with French cinema, and this is honestly, Rob, this is one of my favorite things to tell people about foreign films, is that, you know, we think of them as like the height of urbane sophistication, right? The French, they're so much better than we are. They eat all that butter and they don't gain weight, right? But when French films really hit the mainstream in the second wave of cinephilia in the 50s and 60s, they're not just promoted as something that a very intellectual audience would go to. They're also promoted because they have a lot more nudity in them than American films did at the time. So somebody like Roger Vadim makes the film And God Created Woman in 1956, which is famous for really kickstarting Brigitte Bardot's career. And I'm sure all I have to say is Brigitte Bardot, and you understand what a very, very sexy movie this is. And this was promoted not just as something that you would go see because it's a classy French movie, but actually because you'd see quite frank eroticism in it in a way that you would not see American movies at the time. So even though we think of foreign language films as something that like, oh, we go see that if we want to think that we're really, really intellectual audiences, they're also something that have often been marketed as something quite lascivious and risk-taking as well.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking about foreign language movies with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Maquonago. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you got for us, Tom?
My absolute favorite foreign film is a film called Babette's Feast. It was made, gosh, I want to say it was made in the 70s or 80s. It's a Danish film, all subtitled, but very international cast in it. You know, has people that come in for an opera singer that sings in Paris, and then a whole bunch of different things. And it's about a chef that escapes the revolution and ends up in Jutland. So it's just a wonderful film.
Tom, thanks. That was a pretty big name. I haven't seen it myself, Jocelyn, but I remember that getting a lot of hullabaloo.
Yeah, that was a really, really popular film. And I actually love that example. It's a beautiful film, but it's a great example of how we can use our other senses to get into a foreign language film. Because, of course, that culminates in this incredible sequence of cooking and eating, right? So it really is something that's trying to evoke the sensory pleasures and experiences of good food, good wine, and company. And those are not dependent upon understanding the same language. So I think that's a really wonderful example of how a foreign language film can appeal to all manner of our senses and not just the way that we speak.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Something that's nagging at me, Jocelyn, one of our callers earlier said he got into foreign films to get away from the shooting and explosions in American movies. My most sustained watching of foreign films was back in the day with my buddies. We'd watch the Hong Kong shoot 'em up genre, John Woo and other directors. Lots of shooting and explosions in them. Like, we could find that stuff in foreign language films too, right?
Oh my gosh, of course. I mean, John Woo is a wonderful example, or Beat Takeshi, right, who makes these wonderful gangster Japanese movies as well. Not quite as acrobatic as the amazing fight choreography that we get in John Woo, but Beat Takeshi, his films are just full of, you know, a lot of violence, definitely a lot of violence, but they're also these kind of searching movies about like what it means to be a part of the criminal underworld. We definitely do not have the only violent images here. There's plenty to be found in foreign language films as well.
Now, before we run out of time, Jocelyn, you are hosting the first of two virtual screenings of a Ukrainian movie. Can you tell us what's going on?
Absolutely. The first screening is going to happen on Thursday of this week, and the second will be on April 25th. And this is a brand new Ukrainian film. It's a historical adventure set in the early 17th century. And it's about a group of Cossacks and this gold that they've been tasked to transport between the Ukrainian and Polish border. The film was supposed to premiere this year. Obviously, that's been put into a very tenuous situation because of the invasion and the horrible war in Ukraine, but we've gotten access to this film. So there will be a virtual premiere on Thursday and on April 25th. And it begins with a roundtable conversation that I had with the filmmaker and the executive producer who are currently in Kyiv. So it's a great opportunity to see a film that you would not have access to any other way.
We've got a link to registration for that screening up at WPR.org/Central Time. Again, WPR.org/Central Time. Our last half a minute or so, Jocelyn, name one more name that you think we ought to check out in the foreign language world.
Okay, I will say We Are the Best, which is Lukas Moodysson's film from 2013. He's a Swedish director known for all sorts of genres, but this is an absolute delight of a film that is a comedy about young teen girls who start their own punk band because they're very, very angry at their very normal suburban life. And it is a delight from start to finish.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you so much. I love being on.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today for a look at how to get into movies from other countries and other languages and maybe why we should. Hey, there's still time for you to share your recommendations for everyone else. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page.